Good morning. Please be seated. We're happy to hear argument in our first case, number 114891, United States versus Torres Miguel.
Good morning. The issue in this case is whether the defendant's conviction under California statute outlawing threats, section 422 of the California Penal Code, constitutes a crime of violence as that term is defined under section 2L1.2 of the United States Sentencing Guidelines. Under that guideline, application note 1, any offense that has as an element the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another is a crime of violence. In this case, we're dealing with a threat, so the issue is whether the defendant's conduct involved threatened use of physical force against the person of another. The statute under which Mr. Torres Miguel was convicted penalizes a person who willfully threatens to commit a crime which will result in death or great bodily injury to another person. In the unpublished Fifth Circuit case that we're relying on, Rosa Hernandez, that case was later adopted by, in a published decision, Cruz Rodriguez. The Fifth Circuit reviewed prior Fifth Circuit cases dealing with similar issues and reasoned that section 422 of the California Code does not require that the threatened criminal conduct involve the threat of violent force. In Johnson v. United States, the United States Supreme Court analyzed the meaning of the term physical force, as that term is used in section 924E of Title 18, the Armed Career Criminal Act. Physical force in 922E is defined, the language of 924E dealing with physical force, defining physical force, is the identical language in the guideline in this case. In Johnson, after extensive analysis, the Supreme Court concluded that the term physical force means violent force, force that is capable of causing physical pain or injury to another. As the Fifth Circuit pointed out in Rosa Hernandez, there is a difference between a defendant's causation of injury and a defendant's use of physical force. The guideline in this case requires that a defendant be convicted of a crime that has as an element the threatened use of physical force against another person. The California statute simply does not have that as an element. All it has...
In other words, your position is that under the California statute, you have to have a result of death or great bodily injury, but that there is no requirement that physical force be used to achieve that result. Is that
right.
Your position? You would need that in order to get to use the guidelines enhancement.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you use as examples of that, for example, imposing a force or a causation that results in death or great bodily injury by, for example, poisoning.
Yes.
Or setting a booby trap for somebody, because those things in and of themselves don't involve physical force.
I'm not sure that any court used the booby trap, but I'm not
asking about any court. I'm asking about your rationale.
Yes,
I'm not really understanding why you're relying so much on the Fifth Circuit, let alone one of its unpublished opinions, because there's law that goes both ways. So what we're interested in doing is, as a matter of first principles, if you will, looking at the language of the California statute and the sentencing guideline and seeing how they fit in together.
Yes, Your Honor.
Am I understanding your argument
correctly? You are, and I misunderstood your question. I apologize.
No problem. What I think, to me, is the biggest problem with your argument is this language in the Supreme Court talking about another provision in a guideline enhancement that says that you have to come up with your case or a case like yours in which this example of not using physical force would exist. For example, a poisoning, it's your case, isn't a poisoning case, right?
Right. Well, in that case was dealing with a listed crime under the particular statute.
That is true.
And it was dealing with the universe of generic offenses, and it analyzed state court cases, similar state court cases, and I think that's a different inquiry than we have here. And I
And that is because you think the Supreme Court has made so much emphasis on generic crimes and what the Congress intended by the generic crime by just saying burglary.
Yes.
That the defendant, to extract himself from that provision of the sentencing guidelines, has to come up with not just a very atypical example, but you're saying you come under the general everything else.
Yes.
And so that there's not the same push to come up with something that is not unusual, because we just don't know what these other things are. There is no commonly understood definition for everything else.
Exactly.
Or other violent crimes.
And as I believe you said, when you're dealing with generic definitions of listed crimes, you're looking at state statutory definitions and common law definitions, and that's why it makes sense to say that a defendant needs to point to some state statute or state common law that has an example of something outside the generic definition.
Is this clearly a categorical approach case? There's no claim of modified categorical approach.
That's our position, and we believe the government agrees with that, and I think that's appropriate in this case.
And the district court found this as a matter of categorical approach.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
What do we know about the underlying crime?
It's not in the record, Your Honor.
Well,
now,
is it in the record somewhere, or do we just not know that either?
Your Honor, as a matter of fact, in preparation for oral argument, counsel for the government obtained some information about the underlying crime, but it was not submitted.
But never offered it to the district court.
Right.
Okay.
Nothing in this record about it. Nothing what? In this record.
Nothing in this record, Your Honor.
And as far as you know, everybody in this case agrees this is a categorical approach.
Yes.
Okay. Well, there's some other cases that have ruled on this besides the Fifth Circuit.
Your Honor, I will have to candidly agree. I wish I'd done a better job briefing this case. There are other cases that but it's not appropriate to talk about them since I didn't brief them.
I'm sorry.
I'm just saying I candidly admit that I wish I had done a better job briefing this case. There are other cases that I discovered that I'm not going to talk about because it's not appropriate to talk about them.
Well, are they in the government's brief?
No.
Okay. But you can talk about them if they're in the government.
No.
These other cases support you or the government?
Yes.
They support you?
Yes.
You've got other authority that supports you?
Yes.
From other circuits?
Yes.
How many?
One.
Which one?
Second.
Second Circuit. Second. What's the site for it? What's the name of it? In case I want to look it up.
You're the only lawyer I've ever known that has refused to cite stuff for himself.
The
Good
site
for you.
Is 327 F3rd 188, and I will spell the defendant's name. It's U.S. v. CHRZAUNOSKI.
And it deals with this same California statute?
No, sir. It deals with another analogous statute, but not the same statute.
Okay.
A similar statute?
Yes.
All right.
And it comes to the same conclusion that you would like us to come to.
Well, yes. I will tell you what conclusion it came to
if you want me to.
I don't think that's fair to my opponent, and I'm not.
No, since you said there's something out there, we might as well have the benefit of it.
Right.
Even if y'all didn't find it,
truth. We're not playing I
understand.
It's not a game of gotcha or anything.
What, Your
Honor? It's not a game of gotcha.
I understand.
If there's something that'll help the court, I think, you know, there's a rule that provides that you can, 28J, you can submit a letter or something with something after discovered authority.
I just realized this case the last day or two, so.
That's all right.
You could still, anyway.
Okay, well, and
words to the wise for the next time. You could let the other side know and then let us know. But the government cites a bunch of cases in its brief, so those are fair cases to talk about.
Yeah, and
In particular, the Ninth Circuit opinion in Villa Vienzo Boreal, which obviously the Ninth Circuit, looking to the California statute, I would think has some understanding of what that statute is intended to cover. That seems to indicate and hold that this statute is categorically a crime of violence. Why doesn't that end the matter?
Well, with respect, with due respect to the Ninth Circuit, simply because California is in the Ninth Circuit, I would submit does not grant the Ninth Circuit's opinion.
Well, it's not binding, but
any more
some import here.
Some import. Well, the case the government cites, I've looked at it a couple times. It really doesn't conduct any analysis. It simply states the language of the statute and says that based on the plain language of the statute, it's a crime of violence.
I will grant you that the statute is anything but plain. It seems to be a jumble of words, but
It's difficult for me to analytically disagree with an opinion that doesn't conduct any analysis. It just says the plain language of the statute, and obviously the Fifth Circuit feels differently. The government cited this court's decision in Diaz-Ibarra on the categorical approach, and in that case, this court stated that there must be a realistic probability that the statute in question could apply to conduct outside the definition of sexual abuse of a minor.
But this is what you and I just discussed a few minutes ago.
And I think there is a realistic probability.
Well, and you also think that this, I thought you said that you thought the Supreme Court case was dealing with a listed offense.
Yes.
And this is dealing with the and other crimes of violence.
Yeah.
The residual clause. And that therefore we don't know, we don't have in our mind's eye what fits in there as we would in burglary.
Yes. Okay. And the government also cites U.S. v. Toledo, I believe from the Tenth Circuit, either the Tenth or the Eighth. It was the Eighth. And again, well, not again, but in that case, the Eighth Circuit really didn't have an explicit holding in that case that Section 422 was a crime of violence. What was at issue in that case was whether defense counsel was ineffective for failing to challenge a defendant's guideline enhancement for a violation of that same penal code. And the Eighth Circuit said, well, there's some case law to support it, so we don't think the defense counsel was ineffective. But Eighth Circuit did not even look at the Fifth Circuit precedent going the other way.
I think we understand your argument.
Thank
Let's hear from the government. We have reserved a little time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Your Honors, I would submit that under the language of the California statute, Section 422, any person who willfully threatens to commit a crime which will result in death and great bodily injury, that it, with the specific intent that it be taken as such threat, with the immediate prospect of execution of that threat, that causes the victim to be in sustained fear, and that fear is reasonable in light of that threat, it is difficult to conceive of a situation that would not involve the threat of physical force.
What about threatening to poison somebody?
Well, first I would say that in the Fifth Circuit cases that were cited by the appellant, it seems that the Fifth Circuit was doing exactly what the Taylor case and its progeny forbid, and that is indulging in trying to come up with a situation that wouldn't fit under the generic definition.
Well, you just said it's difficult to conceive, and Judge Motz has just conceived of a scenario. I mean, the Fifth Circuit conceived of two scenarios, the poisoning scenario and leading somebody into traffic.
I would say in regards to the poisoning scenario that the poison itself has a physical violent force on the body.
That it would, huh?
Pardon me?
A small child can poison people. A small child can poison a big man without any use of physical force.
But the small child didn't make a... If I say I'm going to kill you and I'm going to poison you when you are not looking or when you don't suspect it...
Right.
And then you put...
No, that's all we have here, though.
Right, okay.
And then that has to translate into the use of physical force.
Well, I think that it meets the elements of putting the victim then in fear of imminent death or great bodily injury.
I think you're right. But is it the use of physical force? That's where we have to get the two to overlap. So, of course, it meets the California definition. I think you proved that. But does it meet the definition in the sentencing guidelines to get the enhancement? And the Supreme Court has not been unclear about this. They have, and in fact, the sentencing guidelines have been amended. At one point, they didn't require the physical force, then they did require it, and now they do require it again. So it seems that both the Sentencing Commission and the Supreme Court are pretty clear on the use of physical force is key to this enhancement.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree. But I would also quote to you from the Taylor case, where they say one can always hypothesize unusual cases.
Right, and I'm interested in that. I think that is, as I suggested to your colleague, the biggest problem. But they're there dealing with one of the listed offenses.
Right, I understand that.
And maybe you can explain to me how that rationale works in when you don't have a listed offense. Because we can envision robbery, or we can envision one of the other listed offenses, sexual offense, or of a minor, or arson, or extortion. We know generally what those things mean. And so if somebody comes up with a wild example and says it doesn't fit here, we can understand the Supreme Court saying, no, you can't do that. But they're not that's not the government's position here. The government's position is any other offense. So then it seems to me it leaves you open for all kinds of factual situations.
Well, but it has to fit under the state statute where there is a direct threat of imminent death or bodily injury. And I think...
No. The state statute has to involve physical force in order to get the enhancement.
Right, but I'm talking about in the terms of the state statute, so that I think we can envision what offenses are covered. It is.
Well, but I thought you told me, in no uncertain terms, that the poisoning would fit under the state statute. There's no doubt about that.
I think it would.
So then the question is it the use of physical force? I think you're right. It has to fit under the state statute. But it does fit under the state statute. But is it the use of physical force? And I think you just have a really hard time demonstrating that.
It is very difficult because, obviously, poisoning could happen without the person knowing it. But they've been threatened. I'm going to kill you.
So you think that if there's a threat to poison, it would come under the guidelines enhancement. But if you just went ahead and poisoned under the California statute, it wouldn't.
I do. I think if there is a threat, and I think that there is...
I think that's an amazing... I've never seen a government lawyer say that a threat is more serious than the actual deed. So if this person is poisoned and killed, They don't get the enhancement for their second crime. They poison and kill somebody.
No,
but if they just threaten to poison, they do.
I'm talking specifically under Section 422, which is the statute.
Right, to be sure.
And that statute requires a threat. It does not require the act.
I understand that, but I thought that you, and maybe I misunderstood what you said. I thought you just said to me that if you threaten to poison someone, it constitutes the use of physical force. But if you actually poison them, it does not constitute the use of physical force.
No, Your Honor. I was talking about under this statute, the threat to poison.
Well, there's another California statute that obviously deals with poisoning. This
right.
statute deals with acts, not threats.
Right.
This statute just deals with threats.
Yes.
But where is that getting you? Because what we're looking at here is the use of physical force.
Honor,
I don't think anybody argues that what happened here. I mean, the defendant has to accept that he was found guilty under the California statute. We're not relitigating that.
No. Well, I
so the only thing is did he threaten the use of physical force?
There is a California case that deals with anthrax poisoning, where the court found that threat of anthrax poisoning was a threat of physical force.
How would that be helpful in determining what the federal sentencing guidelines require?
Well, just again, that's a poisoning example where it was held to be a threat of physical force.
Under the, is it a Ninth Circuit case?
Ninth Circuit, yes.
And is it cited in your brief?
Yes. I think it is. It's De La Fuente.
Okay, maybe you can spin out for me what the Ninth Circuit, what's the rationale then was.
That threatening, that the anthrax spores would cause physical violence to the body is basically what their analysis was. And I would also argue to the court that...
But of course, we know it's going to result
right
in death or great bodily injury. That's what's required under the statute,
yes,
under the California statute. But doesn't... I don't exactly understand how that means it's going to be the use of physical force.
Well, their analysis, at least as I understood it, was that the violent force to the body as a result of the poison would satisfy that physical use of, or threatened use of physical force.
So basically they're reading out anything, any additional requirement of use of physical force if you threaten death or great bodily injury. That's all she wrote, as far as they're concerned.
Yes, I think they were taking it in a very literal sense, and that you didn't have to go beyond proving a threat of physical force. I would also submit to the court that
the threat of bodily injury.
Threat of bodily injury.
You started off this argument with not being able to conceive of any possibility of a scenario where this where the enhancement might not apply. But isn't your best argument that there is no realistic probability of that happening? And shouldn't we just stop there?
No realistic that in the ordinary sense that the statute covers, the offenses would include the threat of physical violent force, and that the Fifth Circuit, with all due respect to that circuit, was indulging in legal imagination when it came forth with its two opinions. I would also
be fair to say you don't think much of the Fifth Circuit, you like the Ninth Circuit?
In this case, yes.
Do you think that the Ninth Circuit's entitled to any special weight because it's a California statute? Do you have any law to that effect?
No, I don't have any law.
You don't have any law to that effect. So just because it's the Ninth Circuit doesn't give it special weight.
No.
In dealing with a California statute.
It doesn't.
And you agree that this is a categorical approach?
I do. I think the Ninth Circuit probably has dealt with this particular statute.
Well, are you arguing they get special weight here in this situation?
Well,
are you not arguing it? I thought you said you weren't arguing it.
I'm not arguing that it should be given special weight. But
well, there is. Sometimes there's a principle that a district judge interpreting state law,
right,
where the judge sits, might get some special consideration on an interpretation like a state insurance law or something. But I've never heard of a circuit be given special weight because, like the Fourth Circuit, be given special weight around the country because we interpreted a North Carolina statute or
right,
Maryland statute or something.
Which is the problem, of course, and I thought what the Taylor case was trying to come up with some sort of consistency by using a categorical approach so that it wouldn't have to be relitigated in every circuit. But and in this case, I would say that the plain text of this California statute, section 422, categorically states a crime of violence. Also, as was pointed out earlier, the appellant has not come up with any real situation where a state has interpreted this statute, where a district court has interpreted this statute, under poisoning or anything else, in a non-generic way. So I would submit to the court that he shouldn't be allowed to argue that because he hasn't submitted any realistic examples.
If we could go back to the authority or not of the Ninth Circuit in dealing with California law, and you remember my colleague's suggestion that, well, when district courts deal with the law of the state, often we do give them deference. In fact, in the case, the Ninth Circuit case on which you rely, the district court, a California district judge, rejected your position, and the Ninth Circuit reversed.
Right.
So the person who arguably might have some appreciation, some special appreciation of California law, but I think you're correct that when you're dealing with the federal sentencing guidelines, you think we're all of the United States of America, and we have, so that, but if there was anybody that had special appreciation of California law, it would be that California district judge who rejected your position.
I would say it would be the California, the Ninth Circuit appellate.
Well, not true, because there are judges from all over. Do you know where these three judges came from?
No.
Okay, so if I told you that at least one of them wasn't from California, and maybe all three, would that still be your position? They would have more knowledge of California law than a California lawyer who's become a California federal district judge?
No, I'm not going to argue that.
Right.
I mean, obviously.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I was just trying to sort of go down the path of why you wouldn't want to adopt that position.
But going back to that Ninth Circuit case, which is directly on point here, where they pretty much went through step by step the California statute 422, and in that case, they said that using the categorical approach of Taylor and looking at the full range of conduct covered by that statute, that 422, section 422 plain text demonstrate that it requires threat use of violent physical force against another. That is what that Ninth Circuit case held. And I would agree with that interpretation of 422. They say you're not required to strain credulity to find a violation that would not qualify. And you're looking at the realistic probability that the state would apply that statute outside of that generic definition. And in this case, again, I think that under the Taylor categorical approach, the text of this statute makes it a crime of violence, and that you would strain credulity to come up with a situation that where it has been applied in a different way.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hare, do you have any rebuttal?
I will just say briefly, Your Honor, that it doesn't strain credulity to argue that a defendant could very realistically threaten bodily harm or death through poisoning. That's certainly something that could happen. And the government's example of anthrax poisoning, as Your Honor pointed out, still doesn't involve a threat of physical force. But even if you look at the result of the poisoning, there are many different types of poisoning, carbon monoxide poisoning, for example, that involves no damage to the body, no assault on the body at all. It's just, if a person is poisoned from carbon monoxide, they just go to sleep. So I do think that the district court was in error in ruling that the defendant's conviction in this case was for a crime of violence. We would ask the court to reverse.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet the lawyers and then go directly to our next case.